Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
P&L is brought to you by Proper Cloth, a leader in men's custom shirts. With proprietary smart size technology and top-rated customer service, ordering a custom shirt has never been easier. Visit ProperCloth.com to order your first custom shirt today. Welcome to the Bloomberg P&L podcast. I'm Pim Fox, along with my co-host, Lisa Abramowitz.
Each day, we bring you the most important, noteworthy, and useful interviews for you and your money, whether you're at the grocery store or the trading floor.
Find the Bloomberg P&L podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, and at Bloomberg.com. All right, let's get a king of radio and all media, Paul Sweeney, into the conversation. He is our director of North American research and media analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Paul, spread a little intelligence for us. We got a big week. Let's start off with 20th Century Fox.
Right. They say it's 21st century. Right.
But yeah,
I
was thinking,
right.
It used to be. Right.
But they also use 20th Century Fox, I believe, still as part of one of their brands.
That's the studio, right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I was, because I looked at it over the weekend. Go ahead.
Yeah, it is confusing, but they're convinced it was a great name change. This is a great week for big media, all the big media companies reporting. And, you know, the stocks have generally done pretty well over the, year to date and over the last 12 months. And I think, but the big issue for media investors is this whole concept of cord cutting and what it means to the economics of, the cable network business in particular, and the broadcast network as well. If people are cutting the cord, does that mean less viewers, means less advertising, which means less affiliate fees? And if so, what's the trajectory of that downward decline in those kinds of numbers? And that's what investors are trying to get a handle on.
Okay, well, so we're going to get earnings from 21st Century Fox, Disney, Time Warner, Viacom. Which company is the most important to watch to get a sense of just how much cord cutting is happening?
I think Disney's probably the big one, simply because they have the biggest cable network in ESPN, the most valuable cable network in ESPN. And it was Disney a little over 2 years ago that really started the whole concern, the whole issue of cord cutting and the fact that it was in fact impacting the cable television business, when they said that even the mighty ESPN was losing subscribers and that it would cause Disney to reduce their profit forecast for ESPN going forward. So that really brought home to media investors that, gee, this cord cutting thing is real, it's right now, and it's impacting the businesses for these companies. So now, what investors are trying to do ever since that point in time a couple of years ago is try to get a sense of, again, the rate of decline of pay TV subscribers in the U.S. And if you're a bear, then you think that rate of decline is steep and you think it's going to be long term and you've gotten out of these stocks. If you're more bullish, I think a lot of it, and I think that's what's happened with the stocks. A lot of investors have said, OK, we know that cord cutting is happening, but it's going to be a very gradual decline. It's nothing that's going to crush these businesses in the near term. So let's try to pick some winners and losers. And then the other thing that's happening is we're starting to see some of these media companies go direct to consumer over the internet, much like Netflix does, with some of their own offerings like HBO Now from Time Warner's HBO, and some of the other cable networks have done that. Some of the other networks have been joining some of these skinny bundles like Sling Television. So I think investors are saying, cord cutting is an issue. It's a problem. The fraying of the big cable TV bundle is a negative issue for this industry. But there are degrees of how this is going to play out, and there's going to be some winners and losers. And I think investors are just trying to figure out who those companies are.
Is 21st Century Fox a winner? I'm looking at the stock here. This was a $24 stock in September. We're now over 31. We're going to get the results. Super Bowl coverage. Do they have all the pieces to make this work?
Yeah, it's funny. 21st Century Fox owning the Fox network. Very happy this morning after the overtime game last night. A lot more advertising inventory to sell at very high prices. So they love the fact that it was the first Super Bowl to go with the overtime. But generally speaking, I think most Fox investors feel pretty good about the story because the company has a lot of international exposure. They're one of the biggest companies in terms of international exposure with their pay TV business globally in India and Asia and all through Europe. And the bullish case there is that the pay TV industry outside of the U.S. Is more of a growth story than it is in the U.S. The U.S., it's a mature business, susceptible to cord cutting. In other parts of the world, it's still a growth business. And Fox, along with Discovery Communications, are the two companies that are probably best exposed to the global growth of pay television.
You know, last night when I was watching the Super Bowl with my seven-year-old son, he said to me, these advertisements, they are all so dramatic. He said, do they actually work?
Right.
And I'm wondering, you know, at a time when more eyeballs are on the internet than on a particular channel, is there some kind of evaluation of how much these ads work? And are they less willing to pay, the advertisers less willing to pay premium fees for displaying their ads?
Yeah, the global advertising business is about a $650 billion a year business. It grows about 3 to 4 to 5% a year. Within that, internet advertising is clearly the big growth story. It's growing at about 15% per year. So share of advertising globally over the last 10 years has dramatically shifted from traditional media to digital media. You think about search, you think about Google, you think about social platforms like Facebook. Those are the platforms that are really getting the incremental ad dollars. That being said, though, and part of the reason they're getting the incremental ad dollars is that it's easier for them to prove to advertisers that your audience did click on this ad. We can prove to you who it was and that they actually saw the ad and so on and so forth. So some of the metrics around proving the effectiveness of advertising a little bit better for digital advertising. However, as we saw with the Super Bowl last night, you put a big audience together on television and advertisers will line up to pay $5 million for a 30-second spot. So the real challenge for the traditional media is to be able to, again, continue to aggregate big audiences, and big is different today than it was 30 years ago. But aggregate big audiences and advertisers will show up with ad dollars. So the television business is still performing very well relative to the internet because two reasons. One, it's video. And number two, it's still big audiences aggregated.
I just keep thinking of the sunk costs that exist in, let's say, the television and broadcast distribution markets and the cable markets, as opposed to the internet-based systems that Facebook is able to take advantage of, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, they're piggybacking. I kind of wonder at what point does someone play hardball with Facebook and said, you know, you're not going to have anything to write about unless you recognize that we're providing that content.
Well, yeah, Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg just recently in the last one or two quarters has really changed how he's positioning the company, both to just to the world in general. He's calling it a video-first company, a video-centric company. He recognizes that the fastest-growing advertising stream on the internet is online video, and so he is positioning his company, pivoting his company there. So is Snapchat, a company that's about to go public, really focusing on video.
Yeah, well, I mean, who wants to read anymore anyway? Paul Sweeney, right. Thank you so much for joining us. Paul Sweeney, U.S. Director of Research and Senior Media and Internet Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. I'm just still stuck on that 15% growth in internet ad spending. It's just sort of an amazing.
$650 billion a year. Now, I'd like to learn a little bit more about Chipotle Mexican Grill because the shares, Lisa Abramowitz, are down a little bit more than, let's say, 5.5%, depending upon whether you're looking at the open today or the close on Friday. Why? Well, it was a cover story in Barron's, and I just got to ask our next guest, Scott Rothbart, president, founder, Lakeview Asset Management, also professor of finance at Seton Hall University's Stillman School of Business. Scott Rothbart, CMG. What's the future for Chipotle?
The future for Chipotle is that it needs to seriously take a step back and reevaluate its business model. This is a company that was far ahead of the rest of the pack for many years. It was trading at a multiple which was almost twice, if not more than, its growth rate. They had some problems 2 years ago. But management...
That's pretty mild, I must say. They had some problems.
Yeah,
I mean,
they had... Okay.
People were sickened by eating some of their food.
Well, there was two problems. One was that some people who ate their food did catch some sort of disease. And also, there was a problem with sourcing their pork products. All right. Now, this is a company whose mantra is food with integrity. Well, people are saying, well, where's the integrity here? And so it's been on a decline. They try to support the business and the stock through couponing and through other methods.
Were you ever long the stock?
I was long the stock years ago.
Okay,
yes.
And it was, and you rode the wave.
Rode the wave,
right?
Yes.
Okay. Now
I went short a few weeks ago.
You went short the stock.
Yes.
You don't think they can really pull out of this without a big major change?
I think the stock is going to have to basically gravitate down towards an industry multiple of 18 to 22 times earnings.
All right, so it's about $400 a share right now, $398.
If you look at the broader backdrop, Scott, you're not particularly positive generally on the whole restaurant sector.
No, we're not. We run a special restaurant and food portfolio. I also have a newsletter on the restaurant and food industry. And we are now, in terms of restaurants themselves, we're at our lowest exposure to restaurants in many years.
Why?
We just don't think there's value. They had a tremendous run the later part of last year. Probably got overvalued. And we just don't see that the appetite, so to speak, for the consumer is there in the restaurant space. It has begun to pull back this year. We think it'll pull back a little bit more, and I'm expecting, just like last year, a back-ended year for the restaurant stocks. But when I look at something like Chipotle, that stock has bigger problems, and I see this really coming down even further. And I think the management needs to do a few things. First of all, reevaluate its menu, which is stale. It needs to stop moving into other concepts like Chop House, Asian Fusion, and a pizza concept. I mean, there's enough pizza concepts out there. I just think that they've lost their way, and that happens to a lot of companies.
All right. Tell me a company that's found their way that most investors have overlooked.
A company that's found a way that most investors have overlooked. In the restaurant space?
Or any space. I was looking at Kraft Heinz, but you tell us.
Well, I really think that companies you should be focusing in on are lower down in the food chain. I think we've got to look at the agricultural companies, and we own some of them. Archer Daniels Midland, Bungie, the Andersons, companies that are processing, manufacturing the food, because we still need food, whether we're going to eat it at a restaurant or we're going to eat it at home. Okay, we still need the food, and we still need to process and produce the basic foodstuffs.
Although, how vulnerable are these companies to changes in policy, particularly trade?
I think that they are more vulnerable to commodity prices, and commodity prices are very much in tune with currency prices. But again, there's more to it than that, because when you look at these companies, the commodity prices have a great deal of exposure to things such as weather patterns.
Do you buy these home delivery businesses, you know, where they do make the food and it's delivered to your home, that you cook it at home
Blue
freshly?
Apron,
right.
Example.
Yes.
I think that's a very urban concept. I think there's more to the world than just New York and L.A. and Chicago and I live now full time out in Las Vegas. We do still have a home here in New Jersey and in upstate New York. I think when you look in between the coasts, there's just no appetite, so to speak. Again, I have to use that term for those type of concepts. I think OpenTable was a great idea, and that was taken over by Priceline, which we own.
Thank you so much. Scott Rothbart, president and founder of Lakeview Asset Management in New Jersey and also Las Vegas, also a professor at Seton Hall University.
P&L is brought to you by Proper Cloth, the leader in men's custom shirts. At ProperCloth.com, ordering custom shirts has never been easier. Create your custom shirt size by answering 10 easy questions. Select from over 500 fabrics to suit your personal taste. Shirts start from $85 and are delivered in just 2 weeks. With Proper Cloth's perfect fit guarantee, remakes are completely free and expert staff are standing by to help. For premium quality, perfect fitting shirts, visit ProperCloth.com. Custom shirts made smarter.
I want to imagine what is going to happen with the shipping industry this year and what that might tell us about global trade and the economy. I want to bring in John Wobensmith, president of Genco Shipping in New York City. And John, this has been sort of one of the big mysteries. The dry bulk market for several years after the crisis was really kind of sounding alarms about the state of the global economy. We've seen a little bit of a recovery. What is it telling us right now?
Well, what it's telling us is that we are continuing to see growth on the Chinese side, iron ore and coal going into China. You know, one of the big misnomers, I think, is that as freight rates collapsed in dry bulk shipping and probably bottomed in the first quarter of 2016, it was not necessarily a global demand issue. It was more of the supply of ships that are on the water. The sector was overbuilt. And so now what we're seeing is those ships are being absorbed into the market from growth and demand. We're seeing a real slowdown on the number of ships that are delivering. So the supply and demand balance is finally starting to come back into play.
So look forward about 4 quarters and tell me where you think you're going to be. Because, I mean, we go back a long time. So 2014, Genco stock was a lot different than it is today. It's $9 a share, $9.13, but this was a $200 stock at one time.
Yeah, no, look,
a lot has happened. A lot of ships have passed under that bridge.
A lot has happened, and again, as I said, it really has been a supply issue. There were so many ships that were delivered 2014, 2015, and even last year, and now that delivery schedule is really starting to come off. Just to give an example, this is the lowest order book that we have seen since 2003, with only 9% of the fleet on order, and we only expect 1-2% of the fleet delivering this year. And you back that up on the demand side, where you're talking 2-3% growth. So again, you're finally starting to see the beginnings of a cyclical recovery.
Do you think that some of this protectionist sort of wave that's sweeping a lot of different countries and this feeling of anti-global trade could potentially derail this recovery that we're seeing?
Well, I think what you have to focus on is think about what China is actually importing. And by the way, with the exception of soybeans, really nothing is being exported from the U.S. into China. It's mostly coming out of Brazil into China on the iron ore front, Australia into China on the iron ore front, Australia into China on the coal front. And those are the growth areas that we're seeing. So I don't feel that protectionism, whatever may come down the road, would affect those trades. And the interesting thing is, what we're seeing is volume increases, particularly now out of Brazil. Most of the volume increases over the last few years has come out of Australia, which is a shorter trade route into China, and they've been taking market share away from the Brazilian producers. Now the Brazilian producers look like they're going to be able to claw back some of that market share, and Brazil to China takes twice as long. So these ships are out of action for longer, and that should lift freight rates.
The specific routes that you take, I mean, just give people a little idea of what you're actually moving, how long the ships, just how big's the fleet, and so on.
Well, so Genco, just taking a step back for a second, we actually did raise equity and refinance our bank debt in November of last year, and the whole idea was to position the company in a position of strength for a recovering market. So you look at what Genco is doing. We have 60 ships today on the water. We have our very large ships, which are our Capesize ships that are predominantly shipping iron ore and coal again, from Brazil into China, Australia into China. And then we also have exposure to what we call the minor bulks, which is your grains, your gypsum, your sugar, your salt, cement, those type of products that we're also seeing growth on in terms of just normal GDP growth around the world.
So you have amazing insight into what the true growth is in China. I would imagine you're singularly positioned to do that. Do you think that a lot of the discussion that has been happening about China's economy slowing down materially and that any growth that we're seeing is really coming from government stimulus and their money propping up the markets, do you think that that's accurate, or are we actually seeing some steadying of growth in China?
I think you're seeing steadying of growth in China, but make no mistake, a lot of this is infrastructure spending, right? That is what drives the steel industry. That is what drives iron ore imports.
With public money.
With public money. That's absolutely correct. You know, what has also been happening, though, is you've seen some consolidation on the steel industry, it moving more into private hands, which is obviously good for the economy as a whole. And then just switching gears on the coal side, again, coal volumes into China, imports, dropped 30% in 2015. They are, for 2016, they've actually been up 25%. So that has actually been helpful as well. And that is a cleaner product, the coal coming out of Australia going into China, than actual domestic Chinese coal. So that's been helpful also.
Any pushback, any thoughts about the new trade policies as expressed by President Trump? You're traveling around the world. You know a lot of people in high levels of business. What's been the reaction?
Look, I think it's a cautionary reaction. I mean, as I said, in terms of dry bulk shipping, we don't see too much of an effect that will take place because the Chinese will be importing iron ore from Brazil and Australia. The coal will be coming in. On the grain side, China still needs wheat, still needs soybeans. Those will come in. I think the real question is what happens on the finished goods side, right, from China into the U.S., but that's a different industry from what we're involved in.
What's the biggest risk for you this year?
Look, I think the biggest risk, and it's always been this, and that is China, right? And the steel industry. Again, we're seeing firm steel prices. We're seeing growth on the steel side. And all of that, you know, you then get into the iron ore imports coming into China. And I can't stress this enough. Because, you know, you see a lot of news articles out there that talk about, you know, China slowing down. But we saw iron ore imports up 6.5% last year. We expect growth rates of 4-5% this year. And as I said, a lot of that's going to be coming out of Brazil on the growth side, which is a longer haul trade.
You have to wonder how much of that is coming from a sustainable growth in government spending or not. But we shall see. U.S. banks, particularly the six biggest, could return more than $100 billion in capital to investors through share buybacks and other measures as a result of the removal of some of the Dodd-Frank provisions. I want to bring in Charles Peabody, Managing Director and Research Analyst at Compass Point Research and Trading in New York City, to get a sense of how realistic it is that shareholders will see this kind of incredible capital redistribution back to them. Charles, do you think that this sort of seems like a likely possibility for shareholders in the short term?
In the short term, no. You know, over an extended period of time, it's likely very possible. But if you take Citigroup, which I think in that article said they had excess of $27.5 billion of capital, that would require them reducing their common equity tier one ratio by 200 basis points. And I don't think the regulators view the company as that less complex today to allow that.
Even if there is some kind of overhaul of Dodd-Frank?
Even if there is some overhaul. I mean, a 200 basis point reduction in their common equity tier one capital ratio would get you that $27 billion. That's a lot of capital decline. And again, I don't know what the assumptions are behind this, but, you know, there seems to be an assumption that the world is a steady state positive place, and therefore earnings grow and capital grows. Well, we saw in the fourth quarter that capital was actually destroyed at both Citigroup and Bank of America because of higher rates.
I want you to go a little bit more deeply into that, the connection between those higher rates and the capital requirements, but also just maybe you could help us understand the value that we're talking about. Is it based on analysis or is it based on last trade, for example?
Tim, I'm not sure what you mean by that, on that last question.
Well, just the fact that, you know, when you don't have a marketplace for many of the securities or many of the assets, that can affect their value.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, there are two questions you asked. One, in terms of why capital is destroyed as rates rise, is you create these unrealized losses in your debt security portfolio. And there are other minor adjustments as well. And so when you assume, you know, higher earnings power, you're probably assuming a higher rate environment and better margins, but that has unintended consequences to what happens to your shareholders' equity. So we saw book value at both B of A and at Citigroup decline in the fourth quarter, and regulatory capital actually decline in absolute dollar terms. So in terms of what you are alluding to, in a environment where debt spreads widen out, which I think you'll see as the economic activity matures, you're going to see a migration from what we call level one assets to level two assets to level three assets. And level three assets, as they grow, require that you hold more capital, that you can't return as much.
Right. Charles, we've heard some discussion that one provision of the Dodd-Frank Act that Congress is going to target will be the Volcker Rule, which prohibits banks from trading with their own money. I'm wondering, from your perspective, do you think that if the Volcker Rule is overturned, that the biggest U.S. banks would restart their prop trading desks and have the desire to go back to using their own money to make markets?
You know, I think the banks want reduced reporting requirements as it relates to their trading operations. But yeah, I think there are pockets where they will. For example, I've heard the banks say they would like to be more free in how they trade and hedge their treasury portfolios. As you know, under the Volcker Rule, they still can take proprietary positions in cash trading, but they can't in derivatives trading. And so they would like, I think, to be able to use the derivatives trading of treasuries to hedge and their positioning.
And that would be good for volume in those contracts, I would imagine, right? So we're talking
about... It probably would, Tim, yes.
Yeah.
I think you're right. And add some liquidity to the marketplace.
What about other markets? Do you think that they're going to sort of rev up their prop desks?
I'd be surprised if they did it in the commodity space. As you know, most of them did divest themselves of their physical commodity business. You know, energy is probably one area where they might come back. But I think the CEOs are actually thankful that they don't have to compete on a prop basis.
Well, it certainly levels the playing field if you can't play. Well done. Thanks very much, Charles Peabody, Managing Director, Research Analyst, Compass Point Research and Trading. I just got to say that I've never met anyone who knows as much about the banking industry as Charles Peabody.
He's great.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg P&L Podcast.
You can subscribe and listen to interviews at iTunes, SoundCloud, or whatever podcast platform you prefer. I'm Pim Fox. I'm out there on Twitter at Pim Fox.
I'm out there on Twitter at Lisa Abramowitz 1. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
P&L is brought to you by Proper Cloth, a leader in men's custom shirts. With proprietary smart size technology and top-rated customer service, ordering a custom shirt has never been easier. Visit ProperCloth.com to order your first custom shirt today.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.